Blog Talk Radio.
SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket as NASA turns to the private sector to resupply the International Space Station.
Lift to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you tonight?
Well, you know what? I am totally jazzed by that opening audio clip. What did we just listen to there?
That was the successful launch of the Falcon 9 rocket that took the Dragon capsule successfully to resupply the space station and to do some other important things like transport the remains of our own dear Scotty to orbit. So that's a good resting place for Montgomery Scott, no doubt, right?
Oh, absolutely.
The actor.
Actor James Doohan, who portrayed Scotty in the original Star Trek and in several of the movies. And I believe some other important people were in the mix there as well. Not in the mix. I'm sure they kept it. Well, I don't know how they did it, frankly, but I can't help but think.
I'm sure there's more than one urn. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Almost certainly there would be. And no disrespect intended in even going there. But what a momentous occasion. And interestingly, a momentous occasion that you, Stephen, being the futurist that you are, were astute enough to follow carefully. And I noticed quite a few friends of mine and bloggers were making comments about it on Facebook and mentioning it elsewhere. But not a huge media event, is it, really? This, you know, kind of almost quietly, we turn this page and suddenly you've got the private sector supplying the space program. And not just providing equipment to the space program, but actually providing launch capability to the space program. That's a whole new day, and it's a whole new world, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's you know, and what's cool about it, of course, there's many, many cool things about it, but one thing that's neat about it is that they're doing it at one-tenth of the cost of you know, a comparable NASA program. And one of the ways they're doing it, Phil, I found this interesting, is that they – are not allowing themselves any leeway on the launch window. In order to conserve fuel, they had a one-second launch window. Literally, if they had been 1 second off, then they would not be able to reach the space station. And
wow.
So they made their launch window. So that's cool. It's and you know, over the weekend they had a the computer aborted. Apparently, it didn't like what it was seeing in one of the mixed tanks. Within the, you know, it had less than a second to go before liftoff, and the computer called a halt on it. That's pretty good. To me, that tells you something about the, about how well those systems work. That it was able to spot a problem. And within a second, I mean, this is the reaction time that a human engineer would not have been able to do. The computer system was able to call it off at the right moment to keep there from being any sort of a tragedy there.
you think about that really cool and dramatic launch sequence in the movie Apollo 13, going through the checklist. And it's one of those things you've heard it anyway if you've ever watched any of the old NASA films about the big space launches. But it's always the it's always the engines go flight, telemetry go flight. You know, this whole checklist of guys go. And I guess it only goes to show you that it's not just it's not just gas station attendants whose jobs have been outsourced to computers, is it? Mission control is a computer now, isn't it?
You probably have that we're go flight happening, you know, thousands of times a second now,
right.
within the final seconds of launch, checking and double checking all systems, all so fast, beyond the speed of a human engineer, and it makes it safer. And so I was impressed not just with the successful launch, but with the speed at which it was able to call off the launch of the weekend. I thought that was pretty cool.
Those are both really, really powerful stories, and big stuff happening. Congrats to SpaceX and to all of us, because the era of private space exploration, I think, is going to be tremendously beneficial to all of us. I think the era of private space development is going to be the beginning of the true space age. And we got that much closer to it over the weekend. Or not. Ah, very good. Thank you. Well said. Yes.
Because either it's going to be awesome or it won't be. And that kind of leads our show tonight.
That is our topic tonight. Well, we're going to talk about infallible futurism. We're going to talk about both kinds. We're going to talk about both fallible and infallible predictions. But I just have to take a moment to talk about this photo I saw actually on Facebook this morning. And I give credit to my friend John. I think his last name is pronounced Friesen. Facebook friend, so I don't know how to pronounce his last name. This is the difference between digital friends and real life friends. But he posted this photo that I've got up on the Speculist, and it's also up here on the Blog Talk Radio site. And let's just read this sign. This is just one of my favorite things that I've ever read in my life, I have to say. The sign says, "This road may or may not be closed." Big block letters on closed, on or about May 22nd, 2012, for approximately 3 weeks. Now, I read that sign, and I was like, you know, there's almost some information here. Almost.
I love that.
What I said on Facebook, and this is what actually gave me the idea for a show about this, was before May 22nd, 2012, you can put this sign in front of any road in the world, and it's true.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
You know, this sign, this is an accurate prediction for any road. Now, the degrees of probability are going to vary greatly depending on the road and what's happening with it. But as soon as you hedge your bets as well as they've hedged them here, and I think this is some world-class bet hedging. You've essentially, you've stepped up to the roulette table in Vegas, and you put 100 on red, and you put 100 on black, right? I mean, you know.
And you're going to win, and you're going to lose.
Exactly. That's the thing.
That's
yeah, although, actually, it's even better than that, because you can't be wrong because of the or. The thing you can't do in Vegas is make an or bet, right? Here, I'll put 100 on red or black, right? You can't actually do that. But you can do that. You can do that on a roadside. One of the things that struck me about this, Stephen, we were talking about this before the show, and you observed that it has a kind of a legalese feeling to it, you know. And here's my backstory to this sign, okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to say a particularly testy committee meeting led to this sign being worded the way it is. People were getting along less well than usual at this meeting where it was decided how this sign was going to be phrased. I'm going to have to say, there's a lot going on here. First off, may or may not be closed. Now, actually, we can get into the legalese of that, technically, if you say may be closed, you've included or not, right? That's what may means. May and may or may not mean the same thing. It's kind of like when the airlines do their, ladies and gentlemen, flight 316 to Dallas-Fort Worth, now boarding. This will be your last and final boarding call. You know, you ever hear that? It's like, oh.
Yeah, last and final.
The last and final. Okay. You know, you throw in a few extra words because it just makes you feel more comfortable that you're saying more, right? So it may or may not be closed. The word may actually would have done it, but it's like they wanted to sound as indecisive as possible. Then you get to the on or about, which is even more fun because it's like, well, it may or may not be closed on this date or somewhere around this date for, well, we're going to give you an approximate period of time during which it might be closed, right? So,
you know what? One thing I love about this sign is the closed with the slammer, you know, the big type, you know. Everything else about it is screaming, and closed is, you know, just out there in bold, and you know, as if they really had something to say. And
yeah. Well, closed that. If it happens is big. See, I think that's where you know that's a big thing.
If it comes about, road being closed can be a big deal for some people. So
now we're going to get into this. We're gonna talk a little bit this evening about infallible predictions. I actually believe there is that's an inflated word. Okay, I'm going to tell you out of the gate here that in the same way talking about immortality a couple weeks ago is probably pushing past what we really, you know, terms that we really need to be using. Infallible is probably a little grander than we need to get to. But the idea here is predictions that cover a lot of possibilities. Predictions with a good deal of hedging built in are actually not necessarily a bad thing, and we're going to talk about some instances where they're better and where they're worse. And I can think of at least one set of kinds of predictions that are that are designed to, in some ways, do what this sign does, although I think in a somewhat different way, that are actually quite useful and can actually be helpful. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the other kind. Let's talk about predictions that really can fail. Okay?
Right.
Because I think there are lots of good examples of those, and most of what people think of when they think of the study of the future, when they think of being interested in the future, has to do with those kinds of predictions. People saying, this thing is going to happen. Not this thing is going to happen or it isn't, right? This thing is going to happen or something else is going to happen. But actually, you know, putting it out there and saying a particular thing is going to happen, and when you want to get really specific, you'll say by when. So, you know, you get on the board saying this is the thing that I predict will have happened by this particular date, and you can even give a time. You can even say how big the thing is going to be. I mean, it really depends. But my first example of this, and this one is one of our favorite examples that we're always throwing out anyway, but it's a great example of a very specific prediction, a very easy to fail prediction, and it has another component to it, which is the agency of the predictor. That is to say, it's one thing to predict what the world is going to do or what the universe is going to do, but to predict something that, say, you and I are going to do, right? To predict something that I'm going to do is, in some ways, more complicated. You know, in some ways, that requires both a tremendous knowledge of the future and understanding of how the future is going to unfold, but also involves a tremendous understanding of oneself and the role one plays in the universe and how capable one actually is and all those kinds of things. So my first example is going to be President Kennedy, 1961, appearing before a joint session of Congress and saying, before this decade is out, we should set the goal to put a man on the moon. So this is a prediction of the future. It's a very specific prediction. It predicts an event that will happen, and it predicts a time frame by which it will happen. And it's a commitment that an individual is making, and that an individual made on behalf of, in this case, an entire nation. So an awful lot going on there. But that is a prediction, as we've discussed, having talked about the Apollo program on numerous occasions, that could easily have failed. And we would have known when it failed had something gone horribly wrong on Apollo 11, or had 1970 come along, or 1971, for those who actually understand how long a decade is, right? Had 1971 come along, and we never got to the moon. You would then say, that's it. That prediction did not come true. That didn't happen. We didn't go to the moon. He failed, right? So that's that's a really good example of a prediction that was fallible, that was a real prediction, and that came true. So that's my first example.
My example, also from 1969, it came true in 69, Joe Namath's guaranteed win in Super Bowl III.
Right.
It's harkening way back, isn't it? He was basically the Jets were, you know, a long, long, long shot. They were, considered an underdog by everyone in the know. And, you know, Namath got so tired of hearing about, you know, how they were going to lose that he came out and guaranteed a win and then proceeded to do it, to deliver it, along with the rest of his team, of course. Obviously he could have easily been proved wrong. Any number of things could have gone wrong to have made him wrong in that guarantee. But he was able to deliver it. So, I guess that's another example from that same year.
He could so easily have gone wrong, right? I mean, that could have. It's a binary thing, right? Either you win or you lose. It reminds me of there's a real famous clip of Babe Ruth coming up to the plate, and he just takes the bat and just points in the general direction over in the opposite stands, where on the next pitch he hits a home run right to there, right? You know, it's like the same kind of idea. It's like, here, this is where this one's going, right? Sally says, this isn't a goal that we're – this isn't a prediction we're talking about. It's a goal. I'm going to say that a goal is a prediction of our own behavior, that's what we mean when we set goals.
Both in the case of Kennedy and Joe Namath, their own actions had something to do with the outcome of the prediction.
Right.
Unfortunately, Kennedy did not live to see it come to pass, but he was able to lay the groundwork. His administration was able to lay the groundwork, and it came to pass within the decade. So, Joe Namath, of course, was able to play and did quite well in that game. So, it's a goal, but it was also a prediction. Guaranteeing fans is a prediction.
Right. Yeah. Sally also says he didn't actually say landing on the moon would happen in that time frame, but wanted it to happen. Well, I feel that he did say it would happen. He said, we choose to go to the moon. I think if you had asked President Kennedy whether we were going to the moon or not, he would have said, yes, we're going. We can have a very interesting discussion about what it means to set a goal. But I'm going to take the position that to set a goal is to predict one's own future behavior. It's to predict an outcome for oneself or an organization or a larger entity that one is a part of. But let's make the distinction, because that's interesting. So it's not what we usually think of when we say predict the future. So let's talk about somebody that we're very fond of who predicts the future all the time, Ray Kurzweil. Now, Ray is... I think, what's the word I'm looking for? Unique in probably both the number of and specificity of predictions that he makes. I don't know of anyone else who is on the record who puts it on the line so many times to such a level of detail and really puts himself at risk consistently by saying certain things will happen by a particular time frame. I can't think of anyone who comes close to doing what Ray Kurzweil does.
I think it arises from his unique understanding of accelerating technology. He understands, that it's, if we're sitting here X number amount of technology today, based on the track record of our being able to improve upon it, we can expect to be, you know, at this level, you know, 10 years from now. And then he's able to take it a step further than that. You know, he's able to say, you know, not only will we have a million-fold increase in computer technology in 10 years, but he can then say what the implications of that are. And he, for example, was able to predict to the year when a computer would beat the world chess champion. And he was able to do that 10 years in advance. And in part, he was able to do that because he understood what it would take for a computer to do that. I mean, you know, how smart does a computer need to be, give or take an order of magnitude? You know, it's funny. Give or take an order of magnitude sounds huge, but you know, apparently when you're increasing an order of magnitude every year, you can get it. You can predict pretty close, he's able to get the implications right a lot of the time. A lot of the time, and even when he's wrong, a lot of times he's wrong by maybe 2 or 3 years. You know, I mean, he's predicting back in the 90s that we would have self-driving cars by the year. What was it, Phil? I think it was 2009.
And he
was wrong about that. Except Google was testing self-driving cars out in the desert. You know. And of course now, you know, they got self-driving cars in Nevada, testing them even more. It'll be a while probably before we'll be able to adopt them, as Ray predicted for 2009. He might be off by as much as a decade on that one. But that was an unusually he was unusual to be off by that much. He generally gets them a lot closer than that.
Well, the thing is he's undergone a good deal of criticism over the last few years for what does he get right and what does he get wrong. This has become a really interesting topic of debate. How accurately does Ray Kurzweil predict the future? And in particular, there's been a lot of attention paid to The Age of Spiritual Machines because he made a ton of predictions in that book. And there was a 10-year time frame, and all of these things were supposed to happen by 2009, and 2009 came along a few years ago, and people started saying, wait a minute, Kurzweil didn't get it right at all. And they started listing things and saying he said it was going to be like this, and it's actually going to be like this. Michael Anisimov wrote a piece over at Accelerating Future saying Kurzweil got a lot of stuff wrong. There were quite a few people who went on the record saying he didn't do particularly well with those predictions. Most recently, Alex Knapp over at the Forbes blogs did a piece entitled Ray Kurzweil's Predictions for 2009 Were Mostly Inaccurate. He then, the next day, I thought this was a very good sport kind of a thing to do, published a response to that from Kurzweil himself. So Alex Knapp's Forbes blog was overtaken by Ray Kurzweil for one day. And here's what Ray wrote. He wrote, the title of Alex Knapp's blog post is Ray Kurzweil's predictions for 2009 were mostly inaccurate. Is itself blatantly inaccurate. I made 147 predictions for 2009 in my book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, which I wrote in the mid to late 1990s and which was published at the end of 1998. You can read a detailed and carefully researched 148-page report on all of these predictions. In fact, that all the predictions that I've made over the past quarter of a century in a number of different books and publications here. And then he gives the link. To summarize the report, I made 147 predictions for 2009 in The Age of Spiritual Machines. Of these, 115, 78%, are entirely correct as of the end of 2009, and another 12, 8%, are essentially correct. A total of 127 predictions, 86% are correct or essentially correct. Since the predictions were made with a specificity of decades, that is, for 2009, 2019, 2029, and so on, a prediction was considered essentially correct if it came true in 2010 or 2011. Another 17, 12% are partially correct, and 3, 2% are wrong. So this is, you know, he's got his own method for scoring his own predictions, but he swings back hard and says, no, I did get these things right. And I think where there is disagreement as to whether Kurzweil got things right is that I believe that he predicts technology very accurately. He predicts technological capability very accurately. But the thing that is almost impossible to predict is market adoption, is how soon
right.
and how broadly something becomes productized, becomes ubiquitous. So for example,
social
he talks
about social acceptance being a part of that.
Exactly, yeah. So he talks about in Age of Spiritual Machines that we'll all be wearing computers. And the response is, we don't wear computers. That's not true, because people are thinking pendants and clothing and stuff like that. And of course, people actually do. He points out they attach iPod touches to their clothing. You know, there's a lot of different ways that that people end up wearing computers. But the way in which we were picturing it, and maybe even the terminology he was using to describe it at the time, doesn't sound like what we're doing today, because the market interpreted the technology somewhat differently than he saw that happening. So I think it's relatively easy, not that there's anything easy about it, for Ray Kurzweil to predict where technology is going, but it's very difficult for him or for anyone to predict how people are going to respond to it and what they're going to just lap right up, what they're going to run wild with, and what they're going to be very slow and deliberate about adopting, about making part of their lives, and also just that people will go in a direction with things that you didn't expect them to. So I think as far as making solid, real, verifiable, falsifiable, you can get them wrong predictions, Kurzweil puts it on the line consistently, and I think he gets it right consistently. I'm terribly impressed by the just the chess one you mentioned, right?
Right.
Got it if you get that right, everybody else just shut up, right? Anybody who didn't predict that, right? Shut up, you know, haters, right? You know, what do you have to say? What did you predict, right? If you know, and he's predicted hundreds of things that have actually happened. So, I give him tremendous credit, and I think that kind of prediction is important, but I don't think it's the be all and end all of futurism, and I don't think it's the only kind of prediction that we need. But before we switch over, did you have another example of a failable prediction?
Well, I wanted to just respond real quick to the wearing computers.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, who among us does not carry a cell phone with us at all times? I'm hardly ever without my cell phone. And just this week, I have begun at basically everywhere I go. Why is that? Because I'm now accessing digitally all my files. When I do work, I can do work from anywhere. Legal work, and that's part of what I'm doing. I mean, I'm carrying that with me at all times. So. The question is that a good thing? Isn't it good to get away from your work? Well, you know, if you enjoy your work and you intersperse play where in the middle of the seriousness that you're doing, it seems like a good time all the time. So I'm having fun with it.
There you go. Well, and we've also got in the chat room Bluetooth earpieces. By golly, those are little computers, aren't they? And people were wearing those
yep.
Before 2009. I think I had one of those on before 2009. So wearable computers were happening and are happening. They're just not quite what we were picturing back in 1999. That's an interesting difference. Also, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened that I don't know if anyone predicted it. Were there... Although they move in the direction of some of the things he later predicts. I was thinking about this the other day. I got an Xbox 360. So there you go. Phil is a slow but sure adopter of technology with the Kinect system. And I was experimenting with that last night. I'm terribly impressed by the fact that you walk up to this thing and you wave your hand and, okay, we're getting along fine now. Suddenly I've got an interface and I'm able to, you know, move things around on the screen and interact with my TV by moving my hand around. Well, that's like this big step towards virtual reality. And of course, in later predictions in, you know, maybe 2019 or maybe 2029, he starts talking about our movement in the direction of full immersion virtual reality, which he's on, you know, he's on the record for that too, right? Somebody's going to come back in 2019. There's going to be this whole flap again about all the stuff Kurzweil got wrong in the Age of Spiritual Machines about what should have happened by the year 2019 or 2029 or whenever that's supposed to happen. But I couldn't help thinking last night. I got this thing hooked up and I'm working with it. I'm thinking, okay, now I'm interacting with a machine in a way that is completely new to me. It's not new to the world. You know, the Wii has been around for a while, and then the Kinect and some of these other systems are the next kind of the natural descendants of that technology. But we're making these really important steps towards major changes to how we're going to be interacting with technology in the future. And kind of like the SpaceX launch over the weekend, we don't really see that it's that huge. I mean, we think, oh, fun, I've got a game system. You know, I can play UFC, right? You know, I can box with the guy now because it reads my body motion. But we really don't think there's another one, right? We've taken one more step, and we're that much closer to a predictable outcome, and the prediction being eventually that we get to something like full immersion virtual reality, which I think we're getting closer and closer to all the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, there's a couple of predictions that I've made in the course of the Speculist and this radio show. We had our Kindle bet a while back.
Yep.
And I should have gotten these the exact language of these, pulled it out. And then I also had a bet about the arrival of the first generation of life extension technology. And I do remember the year that I put down for that. I said 2014. Now that's rolling around in just 2 years, right?
But yes, it is.
And so, you know, am I going to make it? I don't know. It's still possible because what I talked about in that particular bet, I'm saying that it would be the arrival of something that, you know, probably as a treatment for some other problem, like maybe obesity, that actually does address aging and is and becomes the first generation of life extension technology. We've still got a couple of years for that to
still got a couple of years. And, you know, it seems like there are candidates popping up all the time that can
right.
potentially be your winning technology to make your prediction come true. Now, do you get a big cash prize if that pans out, or what's how's it?
Well, only if you pony up, Phil. But I don't remember you actually betting against me.
I think I owe you on the Kindle bet. I don't believe any.
Yeah,
money.
I think you owe me. We had bet $1 on
yeah,
the.
I believe I owe you one
Kindle
U.S.
bet.
Dollar on the Kindle bet.
One
so,
U.S. dollar.
Next time I see you, I'm totally good for that. By the way, I'm totally good. Four quarters is okay, right? If I give it a change, yeah, that's okay.
No, I want one of those. Like,
a folding dollar.
You know what I'm talking
folding.
About? One of those, yeah, they look like a quarter. Yeah, I want one of those. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, good.
Okay. Anyway, with the Kindle bet, I think what the bet was is that, you know, more books would be bought on the Kindle than print books. Oh, no. I was a little more careful with that, with my bet than that. That print would actually take a hit, as you know there would be a huge.
It was actually my prediction. I was the one going. I'm the one who put it out on the line because what I said was that digital books were going to be huge, but that it would not impact the rate of printed books. That printed books would be bigger
exactly.
than print. That was
right.
the prediction.
And then I came along and said, okay, I'm betting.
And you said, or not.
I'm saying, I'm saying, you know, the Kindle is going to be huge and other e-books like that are going to be huge, but that it would have an impact on print books. And I'm happy to say I'm right about that particular bet. We pretty much were able to lay that to rest about a year ago. When they came along with the it was I forget it, it was but it, it came it, they did a huge survey and was able to show that print has taken a hit because of the e-books. And I can't see how it wouldn't, because if you can get something immediately and it's often cheaper, and you enjoy reading it just as much because you know the technology has reached a point is that enjoyable. Then why not?
Yeah, well, once you cross that chasm, you have to cross that chasm. At the time I made the prediction, I could imagine myself reading and enjoying e-books, but I hadn't really done it yet. I didn't have a reader, and I knew how important books, actual real books, were to me. So it was from the mindset of, yes, I'll enjoy e-books, but this whole other part of my life is never going to go away. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it can totally go away. I think I told you when I put bookshelves up a few months ago how strange and archaic and, you know, antique an experience that seemed to be, you know, getting out all these books and putting them on the shelves. I'm like, man, if I wanted to read one of these, would I even pull it off here, or would I go download it on my Kindle? I'm not even sure anymore, you know. It's like it's too much trouble to walk down the hall and pick one of these up. Now, I just noticed in the chat room that we've got a winner on the life extension treatment. Coffee adds 10% to your lifespan, according to new research.
Yeah, I saw that. And,
it's been with us all along, for crying out loud.
That's exactly right. No, I would imagine that, and I'm talking about something a little bit more than not eating. You know, we're not talking caloric restriction or anything like that. I'm talking about an actual medical technology. So,
yeah, coffee, I think, is kind of grandfathered in. It existed even before you made your prediction. So,
exactly.
Even if we learn to treat it as an aging cure technology, I'm not sure that it's. Yeah, I don't know. We're going to let you win on that one, Stephen. That's what I'm saying.
No. I'm going to go ahead and call it and say that doesn't count yet. It's got to be something a lot more than that.
Although I'll take it. I will definitely take the advantage that coffee provides. And I note that Jeb credits me with being immortal based on my coffee consumption. And I think that's accurate. I think that's how I'm getting to life extension myself. Is I'm doing it. Not even the good stuff. I switch back and forth between Folgers and Dunkin' Donuts. Well, I guess some people would say Dunkin' Donuts is a fairly premium coffee, right? But I don't even.
Yeah,
I hardly even drink the fancy stuff. Okay, so there you have it. There are solid predictions. Put your butt on the line. Say this will happen, won't happen. It will happen by a certain date. This is what it looks like when it happens. I could be right. I could be wrong. Now let's talk about the other kind. Let's talk about predictions that. That hedge their bets a little better than this, and I've got some more humorous examples of these. I know if I'd looked deeper, I could have found many more of these. But somebody who captures these all the time is James Taranto in the Best of the Web today at the Wall Street Journal. He's got a little one of his daily features is called "Out on a Limb," and it's usually somebody stating the just. Ridiculously blatantly obvious, but sometimes it's somebody hedging, you know, it's somebody saying, well, the two that I found with a quick Google search was, this is right after Osama bin Laden was killed. The headline was Al-Qaeda likely to elevate number two or name no one.
yeah, it's likely that one or the other will happen because there's no other option. back when I was in college, we always laughed whenever the college guys would always laugh when we passed the store. It had this big sign out front of it. It was sort of a mom and pop kind of Dollar General kind of thing, and in front of the store it said, "You want it? We may have it."
Awesome.
we'd always chuckle and as a group, if it might be five guys in the car, as a group we'd always say, "Or we may not."
Exactly.
Just come on in and
you know
find
you know what's great about that? What I love about that sign is those were just honest people, right? They weren't gonna say for sure they've got it, right?
Yeah, they could have said, "You want it, we got it." But no, that's we might not.
Well, yeah, there might be things people want that we don't have. We can't put that on a sign. That wouldn't be right. That's awesome.
Yep.
that's That's marketing in a small town, right there, is what that is. That's
exactly.
That's good stuff.
This is the greatest generation marketing. You know?
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Okay, how about this one? One more from the Out on a Limb feature in the Best of the Web today. This one came from Colorado, actually. Thursday's winter storm could be a blizzard and bluster or hardly a whimper. You know, this one's all dressed up with a lot of fun words, but it's like, oh, okay, so it could be huge or not big at all, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. So make your plans accordingly. That's great.
Exactly. Plan accordingly. It's either going to be a huge storm or not much of a storm. Okay, good luck. Yeah.
Thanks for the help.
And people do this all the time. This is actually not this is actually not bad. Actually, the Al-Qaeda one is not as bad as it sounds, because the two possibilities there aren't exactly opposites. They could have elevated the number two guy or not named anyone. That is to say, it wasn't likely that they were going to. There's the third alternative, which some complete unknown gets moved into the post. But if you're not reading that, you don't see that, oh, okay, they actually are conveying something about what might possibly happen there. The second one, I think, is truly useless, right? Because if it was a huge storm, they would have said, see, we said it might be big. If it had been no storm at all, they would have said, see, we told you it wasn't going to be much. What if it had been like a medium-sized storm? Are they going to take credit for that too, even though they didn't right? They didn't include that possibility. I think that that it's interesting to triangulate and square off against what the possibilities are. Not to say it might be this or it might be that, just so that you can't be wrong, but to actually begin to contend with what those possibilities entail. There's a book,
you know,
a good meteorologist,
that's why they they usually will give you a percentage chance, you know, that
right,
you know, and that actually helps. That's actual information. You know, we, based on the information we have a 45% chance of a big snowstorm hitting. You know, that's are you giving any information there at all? Because, you know, 45% chance means it could or it could not, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, 45% tells you something. That's actual information. You've hedged, but at the same time communicated something useful. So I guess that's how you do that.
Well, exactly. I think that that you get as soon as you introduce something like mathematics into it, you're doing something besides just laundry listing possibilities. And as soon as you introduce that mathematical component, you are at that point creating a relationship between those two possibilities, which begins to make it a little more interesting. Think about the debate we talked about. We talked about the Big Fork last week, right? Interesting debate between those who think that we're about to hit some kind of major resource crisis and the world is going to go into massive economic turmoil, and those who think that we're about to hit a period of unparalleled abundance. Now, when those two guys that we listened to last week started talking about those two possibilities, you know, it's not just a matter of we did a show where we said, well, it could be this or it could be that, right? One of those two things would happen. I mean, we did. But you start talking about the relationships between those things. And it was very interesting to hear them talk, and we talked about this last week, how they both gave each other a certain amount of credence to what they were saying. One would say, yes, I do believe that we have the technology that could possibly make this happen. And the other would say, yes, I do think there really are serious problems that have to be solved. So at that point, you're into almost a kind of a strategic dialogue, and you start to see those two possibilities playing off each other, and you start to learn a little something about where we actually stand related to the future. So it becomes not so much a matter of making an accurate prediction as it does understanding why we think what's going to happen is going to happen, and also understanding how those, even without saying for sure what's going to happen, understanding why, if it happens one way, it's likely to happen that way, and why, if it happens another way, it's likely to happen that way. And, of course, once you start bringing percentages into it, that makes it that makes it all the clearer, doesn't it? The other thing I like to see.
I love what Sally says here in the chat room about, you know, whether it's abundance or a massive economic uncertainty. She says, I think both will happen, massive economic uncertainty as we transition to abundance. So, and I think that's, I like that prediction. I'm gonna join Sally's team on that one. I think that's exactly right.
Well, and that is kind of the third way, and that's the kind of split the difference between the two. And what I like about that is, as soon as you get out of a pair of opposites, as soon as you say this scenario or this one, and you triangulate on the situation, I think you have a lot more clarity about how all the different. It's like you're seeing it in 3D now. Rather than seeing it on a line, you're seeing it in a space. And if we think this is the most likely scenario, but that the other two are possible, right? Then we begin to say, okay, well, we have a fair idea of if it were to go another way, then we think it is. What are the things that would have to change about what's happening now that would make that come about? Or if it's even to go in that other direction. What would have to change if we were to make that go about? There's this book by William Golding. It's called The Double Tongue, and it's actually about the Oracle at Delphi. And one of the interesting things, it's kind of the inside story of the Oracle at Delphi. This woman, she goes and she becomes one of the priestesses there, and she learns all the tricks about how they get information from the god. There is actually a god in the story. It's not really Apollo. Everybody thinks it's Apollo. It's not. But mostly what they do is they phrase things in such a way that no matter what happens, it's right. So it goes back to the sign at the beginning. But actually, it's because they understand the character of who they're talking to so well that they give them just enough information to go hang themselves with. Basically, they give them just enough insight into their own character that they typically make the wrong. They typically assume, oh, I see, this prediction means this, therefore I'll go to this, therefore I'm going to be successful. And actually, the other thing is just the opposite of what they expect to happen is what happens. In that instance, it's the predictor who has this understanding of the relationship between what the person thinks is going to happen and how they behave. And it all adds up to a set of circumstances that no one would have necessarily predicted ahead of time. Although obviously the very clever Oracle had all that figured out. And where I see that kind of idea, I think best expostulated is by Peter Schwartz in his book The Art of the Long View. And this methodology, I've referred to it on this show before, is one of developing not just predictions for the future, but clusters of scenarios around what's going to happen in the future. Peter Schwartz did this methodology while working for Shell Oil back in the 80s, and it's the driving force behind the Global Business Network. But basically what these guys do is they tell stories about what's going to happen in the future. So it's not so much a matter of saying this particular event will happen, this particular technology will occur by this particular date, or this particular event will transpire by this particular date. But instead, what they talk about is the world will look like this. These factors will be in play. These kinds of, you know, markets will be opening up. These kinds of technologies will become prominent. These will be the things people are concerned about, and this will be the direction that we're moving in. Or the world will look like this, and suddenly you see a whole different set of drivers. You see suddenly a whole different set of technologies and markets and even nation states that are prominent. Or it will look like this. And once again, you know, the whole set gets kind of mixed and matched and changed around, and suddenly you're looking at a completely different, you know, a third completely different set of possibilities. Now, in the end, the future will probably look more like one of the two or three or four scenarios that they come up with. So arguably, somebody could say, well, this is just a more sophisticated way of writing that sign. But actually, what you know, what this methodology does is it makes you much more ready for the future, because you've been dealing with it in a narrative way. You've been dealing with the future as a future, you know, as a whole scenario, as a whole narrative structure, rather than just as this one big thing that's going to happen, or this, you know, these two or three important things that are going to happen. You start looking at the world as a world, and you say, well, we may be on the verge of living in this world that looks like this and feels like this, and, you know, when you start looking at the difference between the abundance folks and the limits to growth folks, there's some of that narrative structure going on. These guys, we played their clip last week, they're actually to the point where they're telling stories to each other about the about how the future would be. Again, I think it's better if you have a third story. So if abundance and limits to growth had a third or a fourth, even a fourth counterpart, had something to play against them, that the whole idea would be that much stronger. You'd have that much clearer of a view. But once you're able to see the future as a narrative structure or as a series of competing narrative structures, I think you've got a much broader and richer view of what the future might be like, even if you don't have an accurate answer to a particular question about what it's going to be.
Well, John Smart, he being a professional futurist and an academic who teaches futurist studies, he talks about futures. He doesn't talk about what the future will be. He
That's
talks
right.
about potential futures, and he recognizes, and he will admit right up front, basically, that if anyone tells you that this, you know, dogmatically, this is what the future is going to be like, then they're lying to you. They don't know any more than anyone else. What we can do is we can study broad trends and then. Look at what those trends imply is going to happen in the future, and think about how different things will interact to bring us a future, and you know, you're never going to get it quite 100% right, but thinking about these things actually helps you, I think, prepare for the future, even though there's a lot of hedging. I mean, you know, you're saying this could be the future, or this could be the future, and you're hedging just a little bit, but it's still an act of preparation. The most complete scenario I've ever published, of course, is the coffee shopification of everything. Everything
right.
will be a coffee shop, and what I did within that post is just say how all these potential technologies and ideas interact to bring us a future where we do a lot of our work from a common public places like a coffee shop. We do a lot of our education that used to be like in a formal university setting. We might be sitting right next to the guy who is doing work as professional. You might be sitting right next to him at the next table over, learning how to be a professional like him. You know, that is the future I saw is coming based on a lot of things, including social trends like the higher education bubble. So, and is there some hedging in there? Yeah, you know, could I be wrong? You betcha.
But what's great about that, Stephen, is that really does play out like a art of the long view, Peter Schwartz style scenario, because it's got a real narrative structure to it. You didn't just describe a set of technologies or a particular event occurring, but you really painted a picture of what the world looks like in that future. You gave us a glimpse into a world that's really different from the world we live in, and you told us a little story about it. I think that's an excellent example of exactly what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good time to in a show like tonight's show. I think it's time to make some predictions. At least I'd like to make one prediction.
Okay.
I guess we got just a little bit of time to do it in. Did you hear about the paralyzed lady who finished the London Marathon?
No, I did not.
Okay. She, let me get to the tweet that I had. The ReWalk Bionic Suit. What it is you sit down into this suit and you put it on and you strap into this thing, and it walks. It follows, follows your commands and it'll walk. And so she was able to complete the London Marathon. It took her 17 days. Okay, so she was walking all day long for 17 days in order to complete the London Marathon. So let's make a bet about how participation in the London Marathon by a paralyzed lady, maybe or paralyzed people, maybe this lady, maybe others, how they do. 17 days is the first time a paralyzed person was able to complete a marathon for obvious reasons outside of a wheelchair. I imagine a paralyzed people have done it within wheelchairs before, but here we have somebody up on their feet, okay, walking, and was able to compete in 17 days. I think we're going to see that is going to improve over the next few years, and I think it will exponentially. So that we see done in half the time in next year, and half the time after that, and I would say, Phil, that someone in one of these suits will win the London Marathon. Let's say within 10 years.
10 years from now, somebody wins the London Marathon, or a marathon. It doesn't have to be the London Marathon. Wearing an exoskeleton.
Right.
Of course, they won't actually win, right? Because there will be this whole argument about whether they're even qualified.
Well, there'll be an asterisk beside that win, of course.
Yes.
But the point will be made, though. That's a big deal when you reach that point.
I think that's a terrific prediction, and that's a great fallible prediction, because 10 years from now we might still be nowhere close to that in exoskeleton technology. And it also speaks to a future world, a picture of a future world, a narrative that we could be talking about, which is a world in which that technology has become that much more pervasive, in which seniors, not just paralyzed folks, but lots of people with mobility problems are going to become increasingly more mobile than they have been in years past, joined with maybe the advent of the driverless car, and suddenly you have this incredibly mobile world. People who weren't able to get around before are suddenly able to get around, and I don't have a pithy name for that world the way you have for coffee shop future, but I think that's a great way to end the show. Let's look for that specific prediction to come true or not, and let's think about in broader terms what that world looks like, that very different, very mobile world that we'll be moving into in the very near future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we got some good music tonight. Wide Awake from Grantham Road.
Grantham Road and Wide Awake. Well, thank you for putting that together, Stephen, and thanks to everyone for listening. We will be back again at the regular time next week. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio, and until then, live to see it.
It hurts. And we've all been foolish. Answers in my head.